Aleph Pasuk Yud. And here's where HaKadosh Baruch Hu sends a message to Shlomo. Well, that's actually Pasuk Yud Aleph. First, the background. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is angry at Shlomo because of the chait, or the shortcomings, which would be a better term to use, of Shlomo HaMelech. In his older years, he did not sufficiently supervise his wives, who turned out, at least some of them, to be not quite sincere in their conversions or their joining Klal Yisrael, and introduced, therefore, Avodah Zarah practices, which he was unable to stop. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu got angry. Ki natu levavu im Hashem, as the Pasuk says in Pasuk Tes. V'tziva elav al hadavar hazeh, Hashem commanded him regarding this thing, not to go after foreign gods, and he did not observe, he did not watch out for that which Hashem commanded. We find the expression tziva twice in this pasuk. Mefarshim say that there were two commands. One was through the nevuas that he received, where he was promised success in the melucha if he makes sure to keep out of Avodah Zarah. And the other one was in the Torah itself, because Shlomo was not exempt from the general commandments of the Torah that everybody was told. So he was told twice. And the Kli Yoker adds that if this tzivui was not in the Torah, but it was only through the Nevuah of Hashem, Shlomo would have had a little bit of an excuse. Shlomo could have said that, I thought this was extra credit, you know, I thought this was something, you know, special, okay, so I didn't live up to that standard, but I didn't know that it was absolutely required. And I found that to be kind of interesting, because one of the great difficulties in, you know, properly fulfilling our tafkid, and our potentials in this world, and keeping the Torah, is differentiating between the ikar and the tafel, those which are essential and those which are extras. And there's a great deal of danger in that. Some people latch on to the extras with a greater intensity than the things which are absolutely required. And as a result, their accomplishments get distorted. They keep the tafel and leave out the ikar. And a couple of stories come to mind. One I heard over in the name of Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky. The Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky said that a gentleman once came over to him with a complaint. A fellow came to him and said, "You messed up my daughter's shidduch." How exactly did he do that? There was a young man who was working, and this goes back probably, you know, I don't know, it was in the 60s or the 50s, but it was a different environment than today. And very often it was impossible to keep your job if you wore a yarmulke. So this man was in such a situation where his parnasa was at great risk if he wore a yarmulke. He asked Rabbi Yaakov what he should do. Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky told him not to wear his yarmulke at work. A shidduch was read to this lady, and they found out that the fellow didn't wear a yarmulke at work. So they were, they heard a lot of good things about the boy, but so they inquired. And they found out that he got a psak from Yaakov Kamenetsky not to wear his yarmulke at work. Yeah. But they weren't satisfied because you have to wear a yarmulke. So they didn't accept the shidduch. So now he's complaining to Rabbi Yaakov that you messed up the shidduch because you gave him this psak that he didn't have to wear a yarmulke. Otherwise, everything else checked out great. So here you have a yarmulke which is, in essence, you know, based on the minhag Yisrael, not to minimize wearing a yarmulke. He got a psak from a gadol hador, not to wear it, and that, you know, everything else was wonderful, good midos, devoted to Torah and everything else. And, all right, but, you know, so the tafel became the ikar. Now he has complaints because Rabbi Yaakov messed him up. So there's a certain distortion. Like, what is, you know, in terms of the relative value. My father told me a story of a not-so-young lady who was looking for a shidduch, and she was on, I suppose you would describe it as the wrong side of 30. And a shidduch was read when my father was involved. Maybe he read the shidduch, I don't know exactly, I don't remember the details. Maybe he was consulted. But a young man who was in his mid-30s who was working, and she was looking for somebody who was already had a, you know, working, but she wanted somebody who took his learning very seriously. This fellow used to learn 3 hours a night with a chavrusa. That's pretty impressive. A person is learning 3 hours a night with a chavrusa. So it looks like he takes his learning seriously. So she had a question. Does he go to Daf Yomi? So the answer was no. Well, then she's not interested in the shidduch. There was so much hype about Daf Yomi. It means a person doesn't go to Daf Yomi, but doesn't take the learning seriously. The fact that he learns 3 hours with a chavrusa doesn't count. Incidentally, Daf Yomi was not originally intended to be the sum total of a person's learning. And Daf Yomi was originally intended to be a supplement to the other learning that a person does, but there should be one limud that all Klal Yisrael is doing together wherever you travel and so on. Today it has sort of like taken over the scene. In many cases, it's the only learning person left. A person can't do anything more than that. It's all the time or he has, okay? You know, at least, you know, he's Kovei Yitim LaTorah, it's very nice. But it wasn't intended to substitute for other learnings. And here this guy's learning 3 hours a night, but Chavrusa, all right, so he doesn't have time to do Daf Yomi as well. So, again, the, you know, what's the Iker and what's the Tuffel? So there's a... it's not necessarily as easy as it seems to differentiate. And, and according to Kli Yoker, it comes out that even Shlomo HaMelech would have had some degree of an excuse had it not been the fact that it was clearly stated in the Torah as well. He got a nevuah from a Kaddish Baruch Hu. Okay, fine, but you know, not that important. This is more important. But it says Siva twice, indicate that there was no excuse. So Pasuk Yud Aleph, Vayomer Hashem L'Shlomo, and Hashem said to Shlomo, so it's pretty much unanimous consent, comes from Chazal, the Mefarshim, that this was not a direct nevuah. This message was sent through the Navi Achya HaShiloni. We had some debate, if you recall, earlier when there were other messages to Shlomo, whether they were direct Nevuah or not, whether Shlomo was included amongst the Nevi'im, some Machlokas Rishonim, but everyone agrees that this particular message was not sent directly to Shlomo, but rather through a Navi. And I saw one of the Mefarshim that says that it is not normally the minhag, I don't know if there are any exceptions to this, I guess somebody could do the research, but it is not normally the minhag of HaKadosh Baruch Hu to give a bad message directly to the recipient. When the message is negative, it is sent usually through a messenger. Hashem doesn't want to deliver the bad news himself. One thing that comes to mind, and I have to check that out, is Eli. When Eli was told that his sons would not follow, the Kohen Gadol would be taken away from them, and they will die young, and so on, I don't know if that message was given directly to Eli or through a shliach. But in general, the bad messages are sent through a shliach. Kadosh Baruch Hu, I guess, softens the blow, does not tell him himself.
With Moshe, that doesn't count.
Yeah, no, because that was giving the that's part of the Torah. Torah had to be given to Moshe.
No, I mean that he would be allowed to go into Eretz.
It's also part of the Torah. So Vayomer Hashem L'Shlomo. Hashem said to Shlomo through the message of Achyo Hashiloni, Ya'an Asher Ha'isazal Simach, because this claim was against you. This refers to the fact what was referenced in the previous pasuk that his wives, followed Avodah Zarah and he didn't stop them. V'lo shamarta b'risi v'chukosai asher tzivisi alav, and you did not observe the covenant and the laws that I have commanded you. The Mefarshim said the laws I have commanded you refer to the lo yar b'lo nashim and lo yar b'lo susim, that Shlomo took too many wives and acquired too many horses, so he ended up falling into sin. I thought that it's interesting to note that these laws are referred to as chukim, chukosai. A chok is usually the term used for a mitzvah that has no explanation that we human beings could grasp, no rational, not that it doesn't have an explanation in the Olam HaElyon, but in terms of human logic and human understanding, it's beyond our grasp. Truthfully, the mitzvahs of lo yar b'lo nashim and lo yar b'lo susim are within our grasp. And not only that, the pasuk itself states the reason. And it could very well be that the reason why they refer to as chukim is because this was Shlomo's mistake. He thought he understood the mitzvah, and therefore he thought that he'd be able to determine that it doesn't apply to him. So maybe the message is that even when you have a mitzvah that you understand the reason, you have to treat it like a chuk. This is a law from a Kodesh Baruch Hu, and I do it no matter what. So there's a certain element of chuk even in the mishpat, even in something that we think we do understand the reasons, but we may not be quite as secure as we think we are, and therefore should treat it to a certain degree as a chuk. But you didn't listen to these mitzvahs, therefore, karoa ekra es hamamlocha me'alecha, I will tear away the kingdom from you, unisaticha l'avdecha, and I will give it to your servant. It's an interesting aspect of human nature that sometimes it's harder to accept something when we know the mitzvah than when we don't. And in fact, there's a Rashi in Adios that explains the Hanhag of Chazal, that when the Chazal instituted a new takana, a new decree, so there's an interesting limitation on the power of Chazal to make a decree. When they make a gezerah, if the gezerah doesn't stick, if the people don't listen to it, it's not applicable. It's not binding. So it actually has to catch on in order to become a legally binding gezerah. So the minhag of Chazal was that when they issued a gezerah, they did not explain the reasons. They just said the gezerah. And only after a year passed would they explain the reasons. Rashi says, because if they would have explained the reasons, then some people may have thought about it and say, well, listen, I don't think that reason is such a good reason, or it doesn't apply to me, or you know, it's going overboard, or it's this, or it's that, or it's the other thing. And they won't accept the reason, they won't fulfill the takana, they won't catch on, and the takana would be batal. So Chazal issued the takana without a reason. Everybody would do it, and after a year, once the takana caught on and was binding, then we could discuss the reasons and the havana and the lamdas, and we could have nice shiurim and discussion, but by now, it's too late to destroy the takana. So that was how Rashi explains. So it struck me as very interesting because one might make an argument that the reverse is true. If you give a takana, you don't give any reason, and it doesn't make any sense to people, that they wouldn't keep it. So why are they going to fulfill it? Because they have a minas chachamim. They believe in the talmidei chachamim, in the Sanhedrin. If Sanhedrin says we should do it, we should do it. It doesn't make sense. They must have their reasons, so I don't understand the reason. But they must have the reasons that they'll accept it. However, these same people who are ready to accept this decree of Sanhedrin without being explained, without being told the reasons, without knowing why they're doing it, and they have enough of Munish Chachamim to say that the Chachamim probably have a reason, even though it seems a little bit strange to me, but once I tell you the reason, I say, that's your reason. That doesn't make any sense. They're not willing to say, well, listen, it doesn't make any sense to you, but maybe it makes sense to them. Maybe they're smarter than you. Maybe they understand it a little bit better. No, that can't be. I see it doesn't make sense. So, that's human nature. And as a person is more ready to accept something blindly, so to speak, than to hear the reason and disagree with it and still accept it. We somehow can't believe that when we see things one way, that it's possible for somebody else to see things a different way. Just can't be because I'm right. We're willing to understand, to accept that even though I can't figure out why this is so, maybe somebody else could figure it out. But once you tell me the explanation, it's very, very difficult to accept other people's judgment. And this is a really hardwired aspect. It's a built-in aspect of human nature. And not so easy. We can't conceive of our own thought processes being wrong. If you know this, you could understand how to accomplish things in life sometimes. I remember I thought it was quite a clever maneuver by my colleague, Rabbi Mordechai Palgan, who was the menahel, I think he still is, the menahel of the high school in Florida. We had a dress code in Florida. And the dress code was light-colored shirts and dark-colored pants. It wasn't that specific. So what constitutes light and what constitutes dark? We get into these arguments all the time. Well, this is a light shirt. We once had a fellow whose shirt was darker than his pants. So I told him, we got you a Mimarisha. Because if this shirt is light, then so is your pants. Yeah, the pants is dark, so is the shirt. But there was all this quibbling, and it led to, you know, a lot of friction and so on. So Rabbi Palgan observed that most of the arguments were concerning these shirts that had horizontal patterns. Shirts with vertical patterns were pretty clear-cut. It's just the way it was. So we made a new rule in the dress code, no horizontal patterns. Without giving any reason. If you would have given a reason, they would have argued, well, it's a light shirt anyway, what do you want, the horizontal pattern, what's the difference, you know? No reason, no horizontal. So all the kids made fun of it. Why the horizontal pattern? We did it anyway. It was pretty much complied with, and 90% of the arguments disappeared. Of course they made fun. On the Purim play, they had a video. They staged this video because we had just actually installed security cameras in Yeshiva that year as well. So they had this scene where the Hanhala is in the office watching the security cameras, you know, in the locker area, and you see a fellow walking down the hallway with a black trench coat, and then he opens up the trench coat and pulls out a machine gun, and everyone is looking in horror. And they press the playback button. Look at that again. And again, you see the guy walking down, opening up the thing. He's got horizontal patterned shirts. So they had their fun, which I think, by the way, is healthy too. The kids need something to make fun of. But it worked. But I guarantee if he would have said the reasons, there would have been the same arguments. So that's human nature. And if you hear the reason you don't like it, it's very, very difficult to accept. It's easier. It also requires a munus chachamim. Not everybody is ready to accept that either. But if you have respect and for the talmid chachamim, person will be willing. Okay, so I don't understand. Maybe he understands. But if he tells me the explanation, it's a whole different ballgame. It's a greater challenge, and it's not so easy. Pasuk Yud Beis. Ach biyomecha lo e'esena. However, this prophecy will not be done during your days. L'man David avicha, for the sake of David, your father, miyad bincha ekrena. Rather, it will happen in the days of your son. Now, how does the delaying it to the son affect the covenant of David? So, in a very simple way, you could just say that when the kingdom is torn away, it's sort of a sign of Hashem's disfavor. And it shows that you've strayed away. So it is more of a pigam in David if his son strayed away than if his grandson. Because David has more direct responsibility for his son. So if there's a taina on his son, it reflects poorly on David. If it's on his grandson, it doesn't reflect as badly. So that would be the simple pshat, that by delaying in a generation, it's chas, it covers up a little bit for the covet of David HaMelech. The Kli Yakar, as he often does, adds an additional twist. He says, listen, you know that there is a whole shroud of controversy concerning Shlomo HaMelech's birth. Shlomo HaMelech was the son of Bathsheba, and Bathsheba was originally the wife of Uriah HaHiti, who had been led to his death through David's decree, and there were certainly claims against David, and properly perhaps accusations that he should not have married her. So if his son has the kingdom taken away, that could be taken as a sign that this marriage is illegitimate, it was all David's fault. So it would reflect poorly on David. So therefore, even though we had, if you recall, the very dramatic testimony of HaKadosh Baruch Hu at the Chanukah Sabayis of the Beis HaMikdash, that the gates of the Beis HaMikdash refused to open until the Schus of David was invoked. But yeah, that was years ago. Time has passed. And now people may start tumulting again and rehashing the old stories. So therefore, HaKadosh Baruch Hu waited till the next generation. Let's proceed to Pasuk Yud Gimel. Rak, however, as kol ha-mamalach lo ekrai, will not tear away the entire kingdom. Shevet echad atein livnecha, I will give one tribe to your son, leman David avdi, for the sake of David, my servant. And here it's a little bit more obvious, in other words, that the malchus beis David will not end, although it will be limited, it will not end. Leman Yerushalayim asher bacharti, and because of Yerushalayim, which I have chosen. Incidentally, although when it says one shevet, we'll get to that in a moment, really it was two shvatim, but the vast majority of Klal Yisrael today comes from those two shvatim. Of course, Levi as well, because Levi was mixed amongst all of Klal Yisrael, Kohanim and Levim. But the Asara Sashvatim were mostly lost. Contrary to popular opinion, according to at least most Rishonim, they were not entirely lost. But remnants of the Asara Sashvatim migrated to amongst Yehuda and Binyamin, and some were brought back perhaps by the Navi. But there are elements of all the Shvatim amongst Klal Yisrael, but only in small numbers. The vast majority was sustained through Malchus Beis David. So this remnant being left behind David turns out to have been the future of Klal Yisrael. Now, just on a technical note, what we see will happen later when the split takes place, there are really two Shvatim that remain with Malchus Beis David, and that's Yehuda and Binyamin. So why is it said one shevet? So basically, different variations of the same theme, but Yehuda and Binyamin's properties, Yerushas, were sort of intertwined. They were next to each other, and their borders interjected each other, so they were kind of like one contiguous unit. So it's one shevet block, so to speak. The two are considered like one. Right, the Beis HaMikdash has part Binyamin and part Yehuda, that's correct. Now, again, some of the Mefarshim observe this, that until the split of the kingdom, the one Shevet that was most opposed to David HaMelech was Binyamin. For reasons that should be rather obvious, which Shevet did Shaul come from? Binyamin. And Shimi Ben Gera from the family of Shaul, Shevet of Binyamin, was oppositional to David and he cursed him. And they had the biggest grudge against Malchus Beis David of any of the Shiftei Yisrael. So if you were to make a historical prediction as to, now here the pasuk doesn't identify which Shevet it'll be, but if you would describe, try to anticipate which Shevet would be, the last one you would think of would be Binyamin. And this is just another one of numerous examples that that history doesn't really apply to Klal Yisrael. We defy all historical explanations. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is calling the shots. Not that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is not calling the shots in the rest of the world in so-called historical explanations, but his hand is more hidden. But amongst Klal Yisrael, it's just, it doesn't make any sense. So first of all, the whole formation of Klal Yisrael was historically ridiculous. No nation, nation was taken out of another nation. Historians will tell you the way a nation forms is by having groups of people who live together in the same land and develop the same language and culture, and they band together, organize, and they become a country, become a nation. There's no such thing as a nation forming in Galus. It is extremely difficult for a nation to maintain its identity in Galus. And historically, over the years, nations that have gone to Galus disappear. But certainly no nation has ever formed in Galus. And Klal Yisrael was formed in Galus. They didn't have a country. They were wandering. They were slaves. They became a nation. That's something which defies the laws of history. And certainly our current Galus, we were in Galus for so many years without a country, right? I guess you could say in 1948, maybe a little before that, there was already some rumblings of having a country, but even that was under extreme duress and under pressure, not exactly in the normal fashion. But before that, there was close to 2,000, it's not quite 2,000 years, of Galus, and yet we still survive an identity, and not just any old Galus. Galus scattered all over the world and subject to oppression, and still Klal Yisrael exists. And this is really something that the Anshei Knesset HaGedola sort of pointed out in the earlier stages of our Galus, the very famous Gemara. But when it says that between Yirmiyahu and Daniel, they removed words from the Tefillah of Shemoneh Esrei, Hagadol v'Hagibor, because we could not perceive HaKadosh Baruch Hu's greatness and HaKadosh Baruch Hu's awesomeness. And Anshei Knesset HaGdolah returned it, and they said, one of the things they said was, here you have one sheep amongst 70 wolves. 70 is the number that refers to the nations of the world. So you have one sheep among 70 wolves and we still survive. What greater awesomeness, manifestation of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's awesomeness is there? And that we could somehow persevere and be around is doesn't follow the rules of history. Even what we talked, I mentioned it in the 20th century, you know, the formation of a state in Israel, that we have a certain memshala, even though we're still in Galus, and nobody should confuse that with the Geula, but also defies the rules of history. And there's a rather famous story about Kaiser Wilhelm of Germany, who came to Palestine, I suppose it was called back then, in 1909 or whatever it was, I don't know the exact year. The historians here could look it up. And he was making fun of this notion that there's going to be a Jewish country in Israel. He said, four major world powers are opposed to it. There is the Germans, who consider themselves the protectors of the Christian interests in Israel. There were the Turks, who had actual political control of Israel at the time and weren't ready to give it up. There's the British Empire, that has their interests in the Middle East. And the Russians, who were worried about the Orthodox Church, whatever it may be. So you're telling me that you're going to have a state in defiance of the Russians, the Germans, the Turks, and the British Empire, since it's ridiculous. So in a matter of relatively few years, there's a communist revolution in the Soviet Union, and they have more things to worry about than Israel. They're off out of the picture. The Turks and the Germans are defeated in World War I. And basically, Germany's not in a position to interfere in anybody's country, and Turkey loses control of Israel. And the German and the British signed the Balfour Declaration and agreed to have a state, or at least at the time they did. They had some second thoughts later. But here, these four major world empires, all of a sudden, within a span of a few years, become non-factors. So how do you explain that? That's not history. Kaiser Wilhelm was right. But he was wrong. Because Jewish people don't follow the normal rules of history. It works to our disadvantage, you should realize, as well. Somehow, we are the center of the world's attention in a way that doesn't really make any sense. And things happen, whatever it may be, somehow, things happen and Israel becomes so important to the world. And I saw, this goes back many years, I believe it was in the 1970s. But I can't be sure, maybe it was in the 80s, but there was a decade, I don't remember exactly when I saw this, somebody had done a study of the front page stories of the four leading American newspapers. It was the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Los Angeles Times, and the Wall Street Journal. These four leading papers in the United States. Which country was mentioned most often over the course of a decade on their front page stories? So the number one country was the United States. Seeing as how these are American papers, that should be expected. Number two was Israel. Now, Israel is a tiny little country. I don't think it's as big as New Jersey. It's got a population, a few million people, less than the city of New York. And somehow, it's in the news. It's front page of more than anybody else. And I'm sure you're familiar with the more recent surveys in which, in European countries, they consider Israel the greatest threat to world peace. Besides the attitudes that such a survey reflects, how important is Israel? Can you imagine that? You know, New Jersey is the greatest threat to world peace. You know, Sierra Leone. I mean, I don't know. There's probably, you know, a dozen African countries that are, you know, three times the size of Israel, much less stable. But somehow we're so important. Whether it's the Tov or the Ra, the world just can't get over it. But that's because Israel doesn't follow the rules of history. We are talking so important. Eretz Asher Einei Hashem Elokecha Ba'amir Shish Shana Va'adach Ris Hashana. Because the world does revolve around Israel, strangely enough. And it somehow manifests itself in the news coverage and history. We don't follow the rules of history, and strange things happen. And Binyamin is the one Shevet that remains loyal to you because that's what Kadosh Baruch Hu wanted. You know, that's the way it is. You know, Kadosh Baruch Hu wanted something to happen in Eretz Yisrael in the 20th century, so it doesn't bother him that you have a Turkish Empire and a Russian Empire and a German Empire and a British Empire. It doesn't provide much of a challenge to a Kadosh Baruch Hu. And somehow, we maintain a center spot in the stage of history. And that's the way it is, and that's the way it's going to be until Mashiach comes, and for sure afterwards. Now, the pasuk concludes with the expression, Laman David Avdi. That's quite understandable. For the sake of David, the Malchus Beis David will be sustained, and Cheder Kali Yisrael will be under its rule. And it says, Laman Yerushalayim Asher Bachartim, for the sake of Yerushalayim which I have chosen. How do you explain that? If HaKadosh Baruch Hu decided to take the entire kingdom away from David and put other kings in charge, so they would have ruled over Yerushalayim. So why is it this, for the sake of Yerushalayim to have the kings of Malchus Beis David? So one pshat is that kings of Beis David are going to defend Yerushalayim and build up Yerushalayim more than anybody else. Because Yerushalayim was founded by David HaMelech himself, was selected by David to be the capital. He was the one who instituted and built it up. Shlomo was the one who put the Beis HaMikdash there. So they have a certain family, so to speak, connection. And it makes a difference. They're more devoted, more dedicated. A different king could decide, you know what, if things are a little bit difficult in Yerushalayim, we'll move the capital to Shomron or to someplace else. So the loyalty to Yerushalayim would be more manifest and more tenacious by descendants of David HaMelech. Another explanation the Mepharshim say is that Lemaisa, the descendant, with all the tainus on Shlomo and all the tainus on the other kings in Malchus Beis David, they still were far superior to the kings in the Aseres HaShvatim. Because that's one of the reasons why the Golos of the Aseres HaShvatim took place earlier and was more complete. The kings of Malchus Beis David, although they had certain ones who were Rishoyim, they also had kings who were Tzaddikim, and perhaps even the Rishoyim were not as bad as for the most part, as the Rishoyim in the Aseres HaShvatim. Aseres HaShvatim never had a king that was described by the Navi as a Tzaddik. Throughout the entire history of the Aseres HaShvatim, there were different levels, but there was none who was given that title of Tzaddik, whereas amongst Malchus Beis David, there were a number, including Asa and Yehoshaphat and Chizkiyahu and Tzidkiyahu. So there were a number of kings in the Malchus Beis David who achieved the title. Asa, Yashar Ben Hashem, they were Tzaddik, but that didn't happen. So therefore, it is to the benefit of Yerushalayim that they should be ruled by a higher caliber of Malachim rather than be subject to the Aseres HaShvatim, which did not reach the level of the kings in the general. Again, there might have been individual exceptions, but in the general, generally speaking, the level of those kings did not reach the level of the kings of Malchus Beis David.
Isn't it possible that if they would have had Yerushalayim as opposed to the Avodah Zarah that Yerovam put up, they might have also reached that level? And we're looking at it because they had the Avodah Zarah, so
right,
they should have Yerushalayim. If they would have had Yerushalayim,
I don't know. We don't know what would have happened. It would have been.